wrapping the kids out of their coats, the way the babies haven't been born.
Welcome to Teacher Besties, a podcast for teachers. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Kelly. On this week's episode, we talk about what we did over winter break. We get ready to start semester two. We will also discuss the idea of setting reset when something is not going right in your classroom. Students who are more attractive getting better grades, apparently. And subsidized teacher housing in some very expensive areas.
Do you want to go first and tell me about your winter break?
Yeah, I went to Chicago for the first week to see my in-laws, Sam's grandparents. And are you getting a call?
No, sorry, that was my dryer.
That's okay. High-tech dryer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I went to Chicago. It did not snow, so I didn't get a white Christmas, which always sort of disappoints me. When I go from California to Chicago, I expect to at least get a little bit of that Midwestern weather treatment.
Yeah.
It was not very eventful because I was chasing a toddler around, but it was good resting time, and I did not do any teacher work over the break.
That's excellent. I also did not do any teacher work. I think the uneventful holidays are the best ones.
I agree. I do like them, but it's not the same as pre-kid uneventful holidays, which I used to enjoy, like reading and relaxing and binging on Netflix, which I did still binge a little bit because I watched all of Making a Murderer, which is amazing.
I know you love it. So does my husband. I can't watch it. It makes it it's too
just
much for me.
Just angers you.
I can't. I took a big trip, you know. I went to Japan. It was my
I can't wait to hear about it.
I'll tell you more after podcasting. But it was my first time in Asia, and it was amazing. And like you know, and most people who know me know that I like rules and structure. And if there's ever a country that was made for me, it was Japan, because people line up waiting for the subway. They line up for everything. There's not a lot of pushing and shoving. It's very orderly and clean. It was so clean.
Like everywhere or just in Tokyo?
Pretty much everywhere. There were no garbage cans, but no one threw their trash on the floor. Everyone just held it until they found a garbage receptacle, and it was beautiful.
That's awesome.
I know. I was so happy with Japan. Worth the 11-hour flight.
Can you say, since, you know, we're doing our teacher podcast, could you say, was there anything that you would want to share with your students about your experience or anything that you learned for the classroom?
Maybe just like human niceness and treating people appropriately. So I don't even know if it's just classroom, but transcending, just like everyone I met seemed to have a really good work ethic, even at the equivalent of like a 99-cent store. The lady seemed happy to be there and wasn't upset that that was her job. So just like giving your all every day, no matter what you're doing, is any, a good lesson.
Yeah, definitely. Any like content stuff? Like, did you see anything that was history related directly?
A bunch of imperial palaces, which were cool, and a lot of temples and shrines. But I've never taught like Japanese history, so nothing directly content related.
I would even say, like, for myself personally, when I travel somewhere, I feel like much more connected to the mapping of it when I interact with it later. So you being someone who teaches and interacts with maps on a regular basis, maybe that will brighten your day when you have to show them some maps of Asia.
Yeah. I mean, I would say a bunch of my older students who knew I was traveling were really excited for me. And when I got back, they remembered and they came and visited like the first day back at school. When you're still kind of like a little groggy and you're like, kids. Yeah. But they made me really excited to share what I had found. And this one kid was telling me, like, you basically order things in vending machines, even like proper sit down cooked food. And it was just like a very cool experience. Also, you know that restaurant in LA, Nobu?
Yeah.
I went to one in Japan. It was so good.
Ooh. What was the food like?
It was the best food I've had maybe in my entire life. I had a Wagyu beef. I had Wagyu beef and like this beautiful salad, which I'll show you a picture of later. But it had, you know, those broccolis that have like the fractal pattern in them?
Yeah.
which I can't think of. Romanesco broccoli, I think it's called.
No. And you're off. I can think of the word. What is it?
Romanesque? Should I Google that real fast?
Maybe you're right, but I know what you're thinking of.
It's called, oh, I'm right, Romanesco broccoli.
Oh, sorry, my bad.
It's okay.
I was thinking of something else that probably wasn't what you're talking about, but now I can picture it.
It was just so beautiful, and my husband likes duck more than me, and he had some, like, fancy foie gras, which I'm scared of still. And it was just seriously amazing. It was in this little town called Hakone, which I guess is a kind of touristy, and there's a volcano in the town and there's hot springs. And so my view outside of like this really beautiful modern building was just like the volcanoes, and it was great.
That sounds wonderful. I'm glad you had a good time.
Thank you.
Did you bring any cool souvenirs back? Because you're quite the shopper.
I am. I have something for you.
That is not what I was fishing for. But
no, I know, but I have something for you. Yeah, it was just, like, my husband's all about not getting anything that's, like, super touristy. Yeah. And to an extent, I agree. I want something that's applicable, that, like, I use it later in life. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got that in Japan. So I got, like, a really weird tote bag that I don't even know what it says. It's, like, a little weird robot band. And I got a bunch of my nieces and nephews' little cars, which are actually pens. So, like, cute little weird things like that.
Yeah, I totally agree with your husband's philosophy, because whenever you do that, then later on in life, someone will be like, oh, those shoes are so great. Where'd you get them? And you're like, Spain. Or, you know, it makes you feel like very well traveled.
Yeah. I actually had to buy a pair of shoes because, you know, I found those perfect walking shoes. They were not as perfect as I wanted them to be. And
is that because
so,
you didn't break them in, or is that because you think they were not great for walking?
It was because the size was just like a little bit too small. So I had to buy a pair of sneakers. So now I have a pair of, they're just Pumas, but they're from Japan.
Nice.
And I decided that I didn't care if I was wearing an icky outfit, which was skinny jeans and sneakers. I just rocked it.
Awesome.
With my crazy sock pattern sticking out every day. all of my pictures are from the hips up, though, so you can't see it.
That's great. Hips up.
Yeah.
It's a good position. Yep.
Absolutely.
So one other thing that I want to plug in this little section while we're talking is that my husband and I also spent a large portion of the break listening to the Hamilton soundtrack.
Oh, wonderful.
And since this is a teacher podcast, I figure anyone that's teaching American history or even maybe American Lit should definitely like introduce a little bit of that to their students.
So I had a colleague who did it.
Oh,
and a few students were like, what is this?
Really?
And yeah.
Well, those students are not cool.
No, I totally agreed. I'm really jealous. I see on my Facebook feed all the time my New York friends who are all going to see Hamilton. And when I was there in October, it was completely sold out. And the only tickets I could find were like $800. And I was like, no, thank you. I'll wait.
So it is coming to LA, San Francisco, and Chicago eventually, like very soon. They've already announced that they're going to tour. So I want to see it when it comes here. But Chris and I have definitely flirted with the idea of maybe going to New York, but just for like a kind of like getaway and then incorporate that. But I bet that won't happen. It'll probably be more likely that we'll see it here.
Being honest, I'm working with a third of what our Congress has promised. We are a powder keg about to explode. I need someone like you to lighten the load. So, I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. And hey, you're just like my country. And you're not being away. I am not throwing away
my shot. We are starting our second semester, or we're heading into it for those of us, I still have finals to get, is very disorienting. This is the first time I've ever worked at a school where the students leave and they come back and they have 2 weeks of instruction and then their finals, which I would say the only upside of it, which a teacher pointed out to me the other day, is that like you sort of ease back into school after a long break because finals week is like the minimum days and all of that. But it's a little bit jarring for me because I'm definitely kind of a fresh start type person. Like I like that feeling of getting everything done, rewarding myself with a break, and then starting over. And I think coming back to have to teach things feels really it felt really unfinished going on the break, and then coming back feels like, I'm slammed with all these things that I need to either grade or prepare for finals. So that's coming up for me, but then, you know, shortly enough, I will be starting semester two. So what's your semester two starting out like?
I started off with some like housekeeping procedural things.
Yeah.
Like reorganizing your digital file folders. And then my school district is doing this project that they're starting with the freshmen. So we started doing that, all four of us who teach the class. And then I'm mandated, because I teach a digital literacy class, we use computers in order to get our funding. We have to teach them about digital citizenship, which is basically like how to be a good person on the computer.
Nice. Don't be a troll.
Pretty much. And then like how not to sext, and ooh, how to make sure that you're not plagiarizing.
Ooh.
Which is, it's a little bit ridiculous in that I have to sit down and teach all these things, and then I have to sign a document that says I have taught it. Yeah. But at the same time, it's a good first week back activity.
Yeah, so definitely.
I mean, it's like all the kids see the word sexting on the screen, and it's like that awkward silence. but then I giggle and we start talking about it. And then I have like a stupid movie that comes with, it's none of it's my curriculum. It's all given to me by, I think it's Common Sense Media. They do a lot. I'm sure you've seen their logo before.
Yeah.
And so I pretty much read a script for an hour, and then they take a quiz.
I've actually done an article about sexting in class before, mostly because I wanted to get their attention, and I was teaching them like something really boring about research. So my personal example was about students sexting.
That's awesome.
They all paid attention.
So. No, they definitely all paid attention. And there's like little texting dialogue back and forth on the screen to like show like an example. And yeah, and like there's lots of different scenarios. And the best is the classes where the kids decide to act it out. And then there's like two very like bro-y dudes reading back and forth the scenario.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
It's very entertaining.
Oh. Speaking of entertaining, and this is a total side note, there are kids, my classroom is like one or two classrooms over from a teacher that teaches health and mainly like sex ed. And so I can hear ninth graders outside of my room all of the time, or at least for the last like week and a half, practicing like little skits that they have to do in front of their peers, where they're like talking about like, you don't want to get this STD, or like abstinence is the way to go. And they're all just like laughing and saying like, you know, borderline immature comments. But then I'll look out and I'll see these like tiny little freshman boys that sometimes look like they're nine, you know, depending on like their height.
I do.
And
know.
And they have to just like say these super embarrassing things.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes me laugh during my prep period.
I would be entertained by that too.
Okay, so back to semester two. I think this would be kind of a good segue to talk about this article that I sent you about resetting.
Yes.
So this came from the Teaching Tolerance, which is actually like it's a project from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And I'm actually going to their conference in a few months in LA.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But so I just saw this in my feed, and it was just about the idea of hitting reset, meaning like this time of year can often be a time where you feel like you kind of know the habits of your students. And if those habits are bad, or if you are frustrated about certain things, like it's really easy to sort of just check out and give up and feel like, you know, whatever it is that you would have tried in the beginning of the year is just like, I don't know, like a lost cause, I guess.
Yeah, like maybe there's no point in doing a little intervention.
Yeah, so this idea is like just, which I actually remember my mentor teacher back in the student teaching days telling me, like, it's never too late to just say, like, scrap what you're doing and say, we're going to start over because this is not working for my class or my specific students or me or whatever, and to just like give it a new try.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing that with one of my classes. They are no longer like I'm I feel bad a lot of the times when kids say they're hungry, especially if it's right before lunch. And I'm like, oh, well, if you're not messy, you can eat. But no, there is no food allowed in my class at all, ever. And like, I sit there sometimes and like, I'm aware that it is a double standard. But every now and then I get hungry and I have a little snack, but they cannot because kids left apple cores on my floor and that's gross.
That's not cool.
I know. I was really upset with them. But I really like the 5-step plan they laid out. Do you want to go through that?
Yeah. So the steps essentially were commit to change. So, you know, identify the issue and commit it. Name the problem. Seek support, which I think is huge. So figuring out like who your allies are on campus and seeing who wants to collaborate, what resources are available to you. Number 4 was teach expectations. So, you know, spending some time, like actually, even if it's March, just being like, all right, it seems like nobody in my class is doing X, Y, or Z. I'm going to treat this like it's the first week of school and teach those expectations. And then I think the last one is actually the most crucial,
which is
give your plan time to stick. Because I think a lot of times we try something and it can even sometimes be like the same period, class period, and you're like, oh, this is already not working, and it can be so frustrated that you want to give up. But I actually think time is sometimes the most crucial part.
Yeah. I mean, so what I did on the first day back is they do a warm-up every day, and from like the first day of school it was set yourself an academic and a personal goal, and the one on the first day back was revisit your academic and personal goal. Did you accomplish it? Do you want to change it? If so, what do you want to change it to? And I model one for them because it's not fair to disclose if no one else is going to. And so I always try to make sure I grade things in a timely manner, but inevitably life happens. I said I was going to continue to try, and I also said I was going to try to ride my bicycle once a week.
Nice.
Yeah, but it's been raining, and I'm scared to do that in the rain.
So I always would do a very similar thing that you did with goal setting. And 2 years ago, I had a student who like one of them, it was that year that I was pregnant and we were hiking a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And so like one of my goals was that I was going to go for a hike once a week. And so then my students started asking me every week if I was keeping my goal.
Oh, God. No one's asked me yet.
It was actually awesome because it made me keep my goal. But
I was thinking about that hike the other day with the really hilly one. That was really scary.
Yeah. You were like more scared than I was. And I was like 8 months pregnant.
I didn't want you to fall.
I think you were scared for me.
Yes.
So on this idea of resetting, you sort of took like more of a hard-nosed approach. I'm going to go opposite. No. I'm just going to flip it where, like, my personal experience this year is that I have had like a number of classes that I have just felt like disconnected from, or, you know, like to just put it bluntly, like I have not liked the students in that in those classes as much as I normally do. And so I feel like less bought in to teaching them, which I think in the long run has like really affected my ability to be a great teacher. And, you know, like I take a lot of responsibility for it, I think, in the end. Like I see how not being as excited to teach them has made me teach things that are not as exciting. And so I think I'm going to try to have a more open mind and like, you know, kind of reset myself in those classes. And maybe I want to be more specific about it, but I'm thinking of just like, you know, pick the kids that I realize like really kind of get me through those classes and focus on them, and just try to have a more positive attitude, because I think it's kind of a vicious cycle, right? Like when you have a negative attitude towards your students, they will have one back to you, and then it's just like every day feels kind of crappy. So,
you know, when you first sent me this article and I read it, I thought about a specific student I had in one of my classes that, like, really just drives me the wrong way. It's, like, a lot of negative attention-seeking behavior. And I thought about kind of the opposite of what you're saying. So instead of focusing on like the three kids in that class who really get me through, thinking, okay, how can I smile at him and be kind to him so he will stop trying to get so much of my attention or the class's attention? Like, what can I do to make him not so him?
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think this is true for a lot of teachers, is that like sometimes even just in the course of the day, you can feel like two or three different kinds of teacher, you know, like certain classes bring certain things out in you. And I think with like, I have three different classes that I'm teaching this year and three different preps. And I think two of those preps, I am like the teacher that I like and that I am proud to be. And that I think in one of them, I'm just like, I don't know, like I don't like who I am as a teacher in that class. And so that can be really frustrating, and I want to sort of like change that a little bit. So,
well, I think you can.
Thanks.
Good job resetting.
I'll reset, and if not, I'll reset in June.
It sounds like a great plan. I approve. So I found an article from January 8th, and I was kind of intrigued by it because the title is Better Looking Students Get Better Grades, But Not in Online Classes.
Where was this? Washington
Post? It's from the Washington Post, which always has interesting education articles.
Yeah, they do.
And it was a study done at, I believe, MSU Denver, which is a public university in Denver. And basically they had people look at student ID photos and then rank their attractiveness level and then compare it to the grades that those people are getting.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing. I wish I was part of this study.
The author of the article says the difference wasn't that much between an A and a D, but rather from like an A minus to a B plus for less attractive females. So maybe like a half of half a grade, is that what you would call that? But the fact is,
or just like a bump between like a B and an A or something.
Yeah. So not so much, but enough to warrant a small conversation about it. In that, like, as teachers in public high schools, I definitely know that I personally favor better behaved students. And so I don't know, I've never thought about my bias in attractiveness level, mainly because I don't look at students like that. I just look at behavior because, I don't know, there's a large ick factor in my mind to rank.
Well, I mean, it does, like, kind of make you think, though, like, what is it that is influencing that? Like, is it indirect meaning, like, really indirect meaning we perceive those students as better when they're just doing everything that they're supposed to be doing versus a student that's doing everything they're supposed to be doing who we don't perceive as attractive? Or is it like I think like when the student goes to ask a professor for help on something or for like credit for something that they like maybe shouldn't get credit for, like are you more likely to go along with that if you perceive them as attractive even if you're not really aware of it, you
know? Probably. And for me, it's like if a kid is nice to me and then they ask me for a favor later, chances are I'll be more likely to say yes than someone who's been a brat to me all year.
Right. I mean, that's just like basic human behavior, right?
Yeah. And so I'm curious, like, I guess it would be a little bit weird to do these studies in like a high school setting.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious if it's true.
Well, this is also true for how teachers are perceived, because I read an article a few months ago about that teachers are rated as better teachers on things like rateyourteacher.com if you are perceived as attractive. So it goes both ways.
Very interesting.
Yeah. This also made me wonder if you could argue that this like also has like either a gender or a race bias, because like if you perceive someone as attractive because you are attracted to like your own race or because you are attracted to that gender, like does that influence it as well? Made me wonder how that would influence the study.
Absolutely. I can't remember it, but I'll share it with you later. Mark, who was friend of the podcast, sent me another podcast about like 90-second science lessons about this. And it would be really great if I could recall everything that was on it and talk about it, but I can't. And so maybe we will insert that clip if that is not copyright infringement.
I would also like to say, because my husband always calls things like this out, where he's like, well, that study says that today, but another study will say something else differently, that this was a sample size of 6,500 female and male students.
Which is that's a good number for a sample size.
Yeah, it's a good sample size. And it's also a public open enrollment university with about 22,000 students. So that's like, you know, a good portion of the student body.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the article sort of ends with a good question, which is, you know, if professors have these biases, how can we fix that? I'm not sure. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, blind grading is a good way to solve that. Yeah. Not grading on participation, but rather only on merit. But a lot of people would argue that that's not necessarily, like, the only judge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I mean, the difficult thing is, I think a lot of times people will argue that the way that they grade is reflective of other things in society, right? Like you bring up participation. So that's something that would be graded in quotes, heavy air quotes, you know, in a job or something where it's like, oh, are you stepping up to the plate? Are you like voicing your opinions? But probably the same bias is in, you know, getting a job, right? Like, I bet you if they did a study about more attractive people getting jobs, that would be the same.
Absolutely. So if you only had a phone interview versus an in-person interview, like, who would get it? And also, I don't know, sometimes, like, I feel like everyone's, like, a little bit too judgy. Like, no one's really that unattractive. Like, with the proper clothing and, like, look like dressing nicely, I just feel like if you're not, like, beautiful based on Western standards, then that's something that, like, I don't know, the person who's being too judgy has to get over. Like, I don't think I've ever really had, like, an ugly student.
I would disagree, and I will cop to, like, I can't say it about students, but I will say, like, I've had colleagues that I think, like, I know people talk about and they say negative things about, and most of the time it's women.
But don't you think if they just dressed a little differently, then people wouldn't be saying those things?
Maybe, but I also don't think they should have to.
I don't think they should have to. However, I guess if they, like, do you think if they knew that people were talking about them, that they would change something?
I don't know, but I just think, I don't think it should be a factor at all, but it is.
I agree, but we're also teaching high school students the judgiest people on the planet.
No, very true. Like, we're judged constantly, but I also think that that sucks because, you know, I mean, it's not like you're going to be able to necessarily change a bunch of teenagers from thinking like this, because a lot of that stems from a learned behavior that they, and also just like a stage in their life where they're judging everyone based on appearance. But, like, I'm sure there have been a lot of times where I've been judged on my appearance and for a negative, you know, for a negative way.
Yeah, I'm assuming the same thing has happened to me, but no one tells me. And I like it better that way.
No one tells me either. You can just sometimes feel their glare.
Only if I have toilet paper stuck in my shoe would I like someone to tell me.
Oh, yeah. Actually, to end on kind of a silly note for this segment, I actually had a student who... He has no filter. You know, he actually has like a diagnosed learning disability that I won't shout out. But when he says things without a filter, there's like absolutely no malice. Like, he doesn't mean it at all in a mean way. So when he said this to me, I just kind of laughed. But I was, to preface this, I was wearing on Friday like a poncho, one of those ponchos we got from Anthro that, yeah, like, you know, it's not very form-fitting, but it's like comfortable as hell. And I had like some other things on, and he just looked at me and goes, "What are you wearing?" And I was like, okay, I'll give you that. I'm basically wearing a glorified blanket, but
I got a lot of compliments in that, like, not only from adults, but also from young ladies.
No, I mean, I think I would get, I think he genuinely meant it. Like, I don't understand what you're wearing because I don't see people wearing basically a blanket with mini sleeves on it.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
So awesome.
This week I saw in the Contra Costa Times, but I think it's been kind of an ongoing story, that at least here in the Bay Area, as well as some other very expensive areas like New York City, Seattle, and I think even Aspen was dropped in this article, the idea that perhaps some districts would be able to attract more teachers if they had some form of subsidized housing. Mm-hmm. And they focused on, actually, Santa Clara Unified has a building, which I had no idea even existed.
Yeah, you did. Well, maybe you didn't, but my apartment was right in front of that. I used to live right next to it.
Oh, okay. Well, and yeah. I mean, it said, how many people does it say that live there? Not very many, really, if you think of, like, all the people that work in that district, but... the housing was subsidized greatly for
70 apartments.
Okay, 70 apartments. And I know they said that one of the teachers, she had a family and she was living in a 2-bedroom apartment. So just like a 1-child family. But and they were living in a 2-bedroom in Santa Clara for $1,700 a month, which is about $1,000 cheaper than the market rate.
Yeah.
And so... her hope was that she could save her a house while she was living there. And it also said that you could only live there for 7 years. Okay.
It's really beautiful. Like, truly, when I first started teaching and I'm not in Santa Clara Unified, I wished I was because I wanted to apply to live there. And, they told me that I couldn't. I actually called and like started the application process.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I think this brings up a lot of things. One of the most powerful quotes from the article that I really identified with was someone said that it's pretty easy for them to attract young teachers to work for them. But once they start getting into like the family time of their life, usually around year like 4, 5, or 6, that they start to see a lot of attrition and people moving out of the area or just like changing professions because they realize they'll never be able to buy a house in the area that we live in, let alone even rent. So basically it's like right around the time where you've trained your teacher like a good amount, like 4 or 5 years, where they're starting to feel really comfortable in the classroom and really great at what they're doing, they're losing people to housing.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm sure it's an issue. I mean, where you are too, like in your district in the East Bay.
Yeah. They actually, I mean, it was Contra Costa Times, so they were focusing a lot on Oakland Unified, which, I do not work for that district though. I do live close to it. And, both Oakland Unified and San Francisco Unified pay very low, low if not just for where they are, but like comparatively to even the rest of the Bay Area, the salaries are low. But then when you consider the fact that like the median price of a 1-bedroom in San Francisco is $3,500 a month.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And they cited a woman in the article who, you know, basically lives in like one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in San Francisco. And she stays like, she wants to stay in her classroom for longer and work, but she feels unsafe walking home like once it's dark. So she leaves like immediately after school. And I mean, I just can't ever imagine working for San Francisco Unified because of the low pay to like housing, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't even begin to know how to fix that. I had dinner yesterday with another teacher friend, and they were talking about the budget that Jerry Brown had passed, which I wasn't really aware of, but they're like, oh yeah, it's going to be really favorable to schools. I think that it's like raising the amount of money per kid by a few thousand dollars, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And like when, where does that tie into like focusing on teacher retention and like paying a more livable, putting that in air quotes right now, wage? Because I mean, obviously what we make here would be like lovely if we lived in Arkansas.
Almost anywhere. Yeah.
Like any of the middle.
Yeah.
Love the middle.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I mean, this isn't true for the majority, but in the for the majority of the country, but in the suburbs that my husband is from in Chicago, and I think you've said in the suburbs where you're from in New Jersey, they actually pay their teachers quite well. And so those teachers actually live like among the students that they teach, that they own homes in the same neighborhoods, and that they're often like upper middle class neighborhoods. And I will say though that I've often, when there, noticed a lot of like resentment towards teachers, where it's like they sort of like, even though they want the people there want their children to go to those schools and think of them as like great schools, they also sort of I don't know, I think they almost don't think that the teachers deserve to make that much.
Oh, that's not nice.
That's just like a very small sample size of people that I've talked to there, where there's a lot of like, oh, they get these giant pensions and all these like benefits. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, and I'm always there trying to say like, that's also really reflective of where you live, because like we don't even make like what the teachers in my husband's like district made. And
no,
it doesn't cost like nearly as much to live there.
I agree. I was reading something else about like teacher respect in other countries, and looking at Finland and South Korea actually as examples where teachers or where people revere teachers and they're very sought after jobs. And, I mean, social studies history is very competitive to become a teacher in, but if you're a math or a science person, like, you'll get a job pretty easily.
Yeah.
And so just, like, changing the conversation around that would be awesome.
Yeah, definitely. This reminds me, there's this great book, which I can't believe I've never brought up on the podcast before, but it's called The Teacher Wars, and it's by Dana Goldstein. The subtitle is The History of America's Most Embattled Profession. But I have the audiobook, and every once in a while I will like listen to a little bit more. But it's basically just like a great history of teaching. And there's like a whole chapter on how like it became a more female dominated, lower paying job. And you know, like, as you can imagine, it's pretty depressing that like at some point, they just decided it would be cheaper to pay women and to make it a job that they would attract women to. And so they like fired all the male teachers and hired like unmarried women.
That's frustrating.
Yeah. But it, you know, it kind of says a lot when you rewind and then you see. But I would say the most frustrating part about that also is that it makes it so that a lot of people in the profession, I feel like there's kind of sometimes an inherent expectation that, like, in where we live, that, like, if you are married to someone who makes a lot more money, that you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that oftentimes will influence, like, means that the expectation is that it's going to be young, single women who then marry somebody in the profession. And not like teachers who marry teachers is like impossible to live in the Bay Area.
I know. It's scary.
So
I feel like we maybe should have talked about this article first. This is sad.
It's such a depressing topic though. I don't really know what the solution is though, because,
well, I mean, maybe if these districts spent more money on their teachers rather than paying for subsidized housing, then there's your solution right there.
Yeah, so like across the board instead of just like specific areas like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, clearly I haven't like seen all the numbers. I just read this one article about it.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Pay teachers more. That's the lesson from today.
Yeah.
We're in it for the money.
We are. Clearly, we don't care about anything else. Yeah. So, what are you looking forward to about this week?
Well, this is my last week before finals, so I'm looking forward to sort of that feeling of completion and having students, like, you know, it's not as much, I guess, front-loading work on my end when you're doing finals, although there is a lot of that back end, like, can I get this points for this? Can you grade this? Is it too late for me to get credit for this thing that I should have turned in September? The answer is yes. So, and I am looking forward to trying to find some positive ways to change my outlook on a few of my classes. How about
you? Awesome. I am looking forward to, I have every Monday, second semester, Mapping Monday. It starts tomorrow for the first time.
Ooh.
I made little instruction cards with little two-hole punches for them to keep all semester.
Aww.
Because I'm very specific about how maps are done.
That's awesome.
And I'm also, like, I really like to play Mapping Cahoots, mm-hmm. so I'm excited about that. And I'm trying to be positive because I have another one of those really boring trainings on Tuesday. So hopefully there will be something worthwhile. I don't have anything positive about that right now. But I'm really excited about mapping for real.
Nice. Oh, I'm also excited because my seniors are doing presentations this week. I actually gave them an assignment that because I have a small class, it's my only small class, and so there are only 5 groups in the class. I actually made it so that every day they are doing a 45-minute class, like they're teaching a lesson about the country they've been reading about for 6 weeks.
Cool.
And they all, like, a little bit of background, they all read novels that have, like, a specific country as the basis for it. And then they would come together, they would talk about their novels, and then they would talk about, like, kind of what it says about that country, and they learned things about it. So now they're presenting to the class as if the class doesn't know anything about it. They're teaching them stuff about it. So I'm really excited to see what they do with that.
That's really great.
Yeah.
I like that. Let me know how that goes.
I will. I'll check in with you next time on the pod.
Oh, great. So let's tell people where they can find us.
Okay, they can find us on iTunes if they search Teacher Besties. They can find us at Tumblr at mm-hmm. teacherbestiespodcast@tumblr.com. And they can,
you
email,
can email us,
at teacherbesties@gmail.com.
What Perfect.
Else? Anything else?
No, I think that's it. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye.
Bye.
Poncho. I actually have 2 of them, so I could have done end caps.
Oh.